Rumor has it some of you in the back are having trouble hearing me again, and I don't know that because I don't sit back there, so you have to tell me when there's a when I don't have the microphone close enough. We got, you know, we bought really expensive lapel mics that have not hardly worked since we've had them, and then we bought a $100 cheapo set to use in the fellowship hall for the young families class, and it works like a charm, so I may move it in here. Only problem is it's a big headset one, and it makes me look like I'm selling kitchen knives or ShamWows or something. And so you just have to decide if that's okay or not. We're going to continue study of Christian worship. We're going to dive right in quickly. Tonight is our boys' devotional, so first bell's at 7:30, second bell 7:35, which means I got to find 10 minutes of material to cut, so not a big deal. We can do it. And tonight's topic is not one of my top-tier topics. I didn't have an hour and a half worth I had to cram into 45 minutes. I had 45 minutes I had to cram into 45 minutes, so now I get to cram into 35 minutes, so shouldn't be a problem, right? But it is an important topic worth discussing, just to kind of calibrate our view of worship and our expectations. We're going to talk about how culture and worship in the church interact for better or for worse is kind of our discussion. Passages I want to look at right up front, maybe. There we go. Our two passages I want to read to you. If you want to turn there, great. If not, we'll be in other places soon enough. Isaiah 45 and verse 18. For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is God, who formed the earth and made it. He established it. He did not create it empty. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. And then also Isaiah 11 and verse 19. That's not a verse. How did I do that? There's no Isaiah 11, 19. Must have been a really important verse for me. How about 11, 9? That's what I meant. Isaiah 11, 9. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And the reason I read those two passages is Isaiah 45 says, God made the earth to be inhabited. And it's a big planet, and he made it that way. And he put people all the way around it. Okay, that was his plan for us to inhabit the earth, to flourish, to multiply, to develop culture, to subdue the earth as we had it. And his knowledge was to cover the earth. The plan wasn't just for one spot on the map to have Christians in it and nobody else to know about it. The idea was that everybody everywhere would hear about God and know about him and would worship him and bring him glory. That's the basic idea of those two verses. What's that mean for us? Well, God filled the whole earth with people, and God expected all people everywhere to know him and worship him. Are all those people basically the same in the way they behave from day to day all over the earth? Would you notice if a tornado picked up your house and dropped it into Kyoto, Japan, would you notice or would you think you were probably still in Glenpool? Might be a little bit different, right? And so one observation we make is that in different places, people live, eat, work, speak, etc., differently, right? Even the very ordinary things about life are different from place to place. There's some things that are common to all of us. Humans have some of the same basic needs everywhere, but how they go about life looks very different in different places. So our question for tonight is simply this: in what ways should these differences in culture influence or not influence the church's worship and other things that it does? We could, you know, tack on the end of that. Should a worship service look identical in Glenpool, Oklahoma, as it does in Kenya? What kind of differences do we expect? What kind of differences should mostly be the same? And when you think of it that way, then you can ask the question more likely to ask, in what way should a worship service look the same on one side of Glenpool and the other side of Glenpool, right? How much distinction do we expect to see and how much should it be the same as a question worth asking? One thing the Bible does tell us is that God expects there to be a considerable amount of diversity in his church. Look in Galatians chapter 3. And I think I'll be in the New Testament for the rest of the class, so if you want to flip over there. Galatians chapter 3. Does somebody want to read to us from Galatians chapter 3, 27 through 29? Galatians chapter 3, 27 through 29. Carl, go ahead. Thank you. Thank you. So one of the debates going on apparently in the church at this time was, what about Jews and Gentiles? And in responding to that, chapter 3 is the big response. But at the end of chapter 3, he says more than just Jew and Gentile. He makes a much bigger picture. He says, neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, you're all one in Christ Jesus. That in Paul's picture of how the church is supposed to look, in the first racially charged debate in Christian history between Jew and Gentile, his answer is that we don't observe and accept racial divisions, ethnic divisions, and divisions of this sort in among God's people. Paul says a baptized person is a baptized person, is a child of Abraham. That's his story, and he's sticking to it. And he, how much does he believe it? In Galatians chapter 2, 11 through 14, he recounts a story where he picked a little fight with Peter to make the point, right? Where Peter was not observing. Peter didn't come out and say, I don't like Gentiles. He was just treating them differently. He got up and moved to the other side of the room, as it were, for dinner, based on maybe kosher laws or different things going on there. Whatever it was, Peter distanced himself from Gentiles. And Paul says, that's not how we do it. He said, I withstood him to the face. He was adamant about it. Okay, probably in our church and in churches you're familiar with, you don't have a fight over Jew and Gentile distinctions, do we? That's just not an issue that comes up. Probably because none of us are Jewish, starters. But we do have other issues that are culturally related. Race and racial culture remain instruments of division today. Sometimes it results from sin in the human heart, the actual presence of racism. Sometimes it results from people who want to use the issues of race as a wedge to create power for themselves. So there are people that profit and get ahead by using a racial language, and then there are actual problems of race. So to make things worse, right, there's the actual problem, and then the problem we make on top of the actual problem, which makes the problem worse. And so in our country, we're deeply susceptible to problems that are racially related. Can those affect the church? Sure they can, and often do. There's a quote from Martin Luther King that I find bothering. Every time I read it, I think, I hope that's not true, but it probably is. He said, it is appalling that the most segregated hour of Christian America is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. That in terms of unity of our culture, you don't have a whites-only restroom or a blacks-only restroom. That battle's over. But as far as our culture, we do still quite often, voluntarily, no one's imposing it, it's not a federal law, but we voluntarily kind of divide ourselves based on race and so forth in our churches. That's so typical that we don't even notice it. We don't have anything to say about it. What causes that? I'd have to be a psychologist to give you all the answers of what causes that. Is it actually racism? I suspect in some cases there is actual racism. I'm not naive enough to think there's no such thing as racism in the world today. It exists, okay? So in some cases, that probably is the case. Other times, it's comfort, that you feel more comfortable with people who are like you. Psychologically, we are programmed and hardwired to notice that. So there was an interesting study. I promise I'm not going to do a psychological lesson, but there was an interesting study they did that I was reading the other day where they had a jar of like marbles or jelly beans or something, okay? And they asked people to guess how many were in the jar, okay? And then they told them, all the people that had too high a number, go stand over here in this room, and all the people that had too low a number, go stand over here in this room. So they divided them up, and then they let them talk and mingle a little bit. Lo and behold, all the people that something as arbitrary as guessing too high started to talk about what things they had in common. You know, we guess too high because we're optimists, and we think this way, and you know, you grew up this way. Oh, yeah. And they start to talk about how much they have in common and how much better they are than the other group. And the other group that had guessed too low starts talking about how more realistic and practical they are than those crazy people. It's a completely arbitrary distinction. And then here's the catch, right? You think this is silly so far? At the end, the people doing the study says, we didn't actually divide you based on who guessed what. We made that up. We just randomly divided you into rooms. And based on that, you decided the people in your room were better than people in the other room. And they did this more than once and repeated the study, and they kept getting the same result. And the strange thing is that humans, you stick them in a room, they're going to find people they think are like them and decide that those people are better than the other people. It's something wrong with the way we think. Okay? Can that happen in churches? You bet it can. Can it happen? Can it be racial related? Sure. It doesn't have to be just black and white. It can relate to Hispanic and so forth. There are a lot of different cultures and ethnicities in our culture, the way we treat Native Americans, and all of that substrata based on prosperity and wealth, right? Culture. There are so many different ways that if people given half a chance will divide themselves up into groups. And so Christians are always struggling with that human tendency to identify with our group. Is it always evil to identify with your group? Probably not. Comfort-wise, maybe you just find things in common with certain people. That's not a bad thing. But it seems to very often lead to bad things. And that's the danger that Christians struggle with. Does it sometimes change the way we worship when you are associated with certain people that behave a certain way and they worship a certain way? It can cause a division even in the worship assembly. And so I think, I don't have a whole 40-minute speech, I promise, on racism in the church, but I did think it was worthwhile to comment on that reality as it affects churches and to prove my point that this is a reality in churches of Christ and has been. We'll do a little repenting tonight. I'm going to tell you a little story, and I thought, why not go close to home? I'm going to pick my own hero, okay? Growing up, my dad was kind of mentored and heavily influenced by a preacher in Churches of Christ named Foy E. Wallace Jr., okay? And he was very influential in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s, and was a big impact on Dad growing up. I've got his books all over my shelf. He's been very influential on me, and I am grateful for everything he did, so I'm about to tell you something bad about him. Before I do all that, I'm very grateful for all the good he did in the world, okay? For years, when I would interact with other people from Churches of Christ, but different backgrounds, I'd mentioned Foy Wallace, and they didn't get as excited as I did. And I thought, well, they're liberal. That's the problem. And I thought, clearly, they just didn't like what he taught. And finally, one of them said, you know, he was like a really bad racist, right? It's like, oh, come on. Dad wasn't best buds with a terrible racist. And they showed me some, like, he was the editor of the Gospel Advocate and several of our major church papers for a while. And they showed me some of the things he wrote in the 40s. And, you know, when you first read something that's, you know, 60 years old, you think, well, that's the way people talk back then. And you try to kind of excuse it. He grew up in Texas in the South, and maybe that's the way it was. And then I stumbled onto this paragraph I'm going to show you, and I thought, yeah, okay, he's a racist. I can't, like, excuse that one and say, I'm sure he meant well. I read it, and I thought, that's just a terrible thing. How can the person I admire have said, better yet, written that, read it and thought, yep, I'm going to print that in a journal somewhere, right? Here's the quote. He's talking about gospel meetings that he has hosted among white churches and the tendency to have black ministers host some of these churches as well. Let's see if I can advance the slide. Hope you can read it. If not, I'll read it to you. He says, I am very much in favor of Negro meetings for the Negroes, but I am just as much opposed to Negro meetings for white people. And I am against white brethren taking the meetings away from the Negroes and the general mixing that has become entirely too much of a practice in these Negro meetings. Such a thing not only lowers the church in the eyes of the world, but it is definitely against the interest of the Negroes. If any Negro preacher says that this is not true, that will be the evidence that it is true, and that he has been spoiled by the white brethren and wants to preach to white audiences. And if any of the white brethren get worked up over that and what I've said and want to accuse me of being jealous of the Negro preachers, I'll just tell them now that I don't even want to hold a meeting for any bunch of brethren who think that any Negro is a better preacher than I am. You're all the way through there, I'm thinking, well, is there a way to explain this where it doesn't sound as bad as, and you get to the end, you think, how does a person say that? A guy, you read his sermon, he's got a book on the Sermon on the Mount, And it talks about meekness and kindness and gentility and so forth. And then, hey, if you think a Negro can preach better than me, I don't even want to talk to you. And you think, how do you get there from there? My point is that it can become part of essentially, it sneaks its way in. Sin is insidious. It is sneaky. And it can corrupt people that you otherwise admire. And that means it can be bad in my life too, couldn't it? I think I'm a pretty good guy and not a racist, right? But if my heroes have the capacity to fall to that, well, maybe I ought to weigh on the watch for it too. So I think we have to be aware of it. We've got some repenting to do in our heritage where we've had some bad days in our past. And it's something we need to be aware of when we view churches that made up of different looking people than us. And sometimes they will behave differently in worship. And we may make a determination one way or another based on our comfort level. Does that make any sense at all? Or was I rambling for 30 minutes? Okay. Let me talk about some other issues of culture. Was there a hand up? I thought I saw one. I might have made that up. Okay. Other differences that are culturally related. I'm having real trouble advancing my slides tonight. I don't know what I've done wrong. There it goes. What posture should we use in worship? Now, if you grew up in churches of Christ I grew up in, you know what you're supposed to do. You know when you're supposed to sit. You know when you're supposed to stand. And you know when to be quiet, right? Because that was something your mama taught you really early on, right? Your mama taught you, hush now. So I'll tell this story. Really early on, there was a Sunday in Germride, Oklahoma, where my dad was preaching, where mom was sick, or one of the kids was sick, and mom was home with all the kids. And so dad took me to church by himself. Mistake number one, rookie preacher mistake right there. He took me to church with him by himself. Mistake number two, rather than handing me off to one of the little old ladies, of which Drumright had several, he decided to set me down at all of 3 years old on the front row, and that I would just behave myself through the sermon. I decided it needed some affirmation, like that people clearly were not understanding how good a sermon Dad was preaching. And so I kind of started in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yep. Amen. Right, and it just kind of keeps getting louder and louder. And Dad kind of starts quietly, too, with the hush, hush, hush. And if you haven't been called down from the pulpit by your father, you just haven't lived. But the point is, you know, we're taught real early on when to hush, right? We know kind of in our culture, this is the way it works, and we're decently in an order, and this is the way it goes. You look in the Bible, there are a variety of postures and behaviors during worship. People interact with it differently. In Ephesians 3, Paul talks about bending the knee in prayer. How many of you bend the knee when you pray? I mean, literally bend a knee when you pray. Paul did. He's not telling you have to. Maybe your knees don't work so good. But he apparently did. I mean, he used that not just as a metaphor. It described the way he prayed. He bent his knee and he knelt and prayed. We sing kneel at the cross, and probably hadn't any of us knelt for anything in a long time. Bowing the head in Luke chapter 18 and verse 13 is a description of prayer. That was why people bowed the head. Remember the man who went up to the temple to pray, the Pharisee, he shouts to God, but the publican won't so much as lift his eyes up to heaven. So as a sign of humility, he bows his head. 1 Timothy 2:8 refers to raising hands. Referring to raising holy hands in prayer, which I think is probably descriptive of the fact that you're supposed to be a holy manner of life. But regardless, he describes the posture associated with that as lifting up hands in prayer. If I lifted my hands in a service, my dad would call on me because he would think I had a question, And that so I learned it real early, you don't do that. Mark 14:35, they worship while completely down, face first on the ground. And Luke 18:11-13, they're standing. And James 2:3, they're sitting. And if you want a really weird one, Acts 3:8, he's leaping. He's skipping into the temple. He's very excited. This is a man that has been healed by the apostles. And they're in the temple, and he's skipping around and jumping. Okay, it's a little more lively. Which one is the right and appropriate posture? None of them are right or wrong. They are all things that people have done during worship, based on what was seen as appropriate in that culture or setting. And the Bible simply doesn't render a verdict on that. We have normal things that we do. So I'll give you an example on this on our summer series this summer. Kent Brown is a frequent guest for our summer series from Oklahoma City. He's a friend of mine. And he always does the invitation at the end of his class, or at the end of the devotional. He does the devotional at the end of the service, is what I'm trying to say. Well, at his church, they don't do an invitation at the end of the Wednesday night devotional. So he's not in the habit of doing that. So three times he's been here, and three times he's forgotten to say, as we stand and sing, at the end of his Wednesday night talk. Do you want to guess what everybody in the room did, regardless of whether he told you to or not, at the end of his talk? All three times people get up and he looks around and goes, oh. Because we all know the cues, right? We are trained and programmed. At the end of the sermon, you get up and you sing. That's what you're supposed to do. And that's not any more wrong than a congregation that didn't do that, right? It's just that's what we do. And so those are examples, I'm trying to say, those are examples where you have a culture in a congregation. Some of it has to do with where people were when they grew up and how they worshiped there, what their mamas slapped their hands over when they were little kids, all those things, what their dad shouted at them from the pulpit, all of those things, see, Paula knows, all those things influence kind of what you come to expect in worship. And we use those as kind of general guidelines. It's fine to have them. It's perfectly fine. I'm not saying don't stand and sing. What I am saying is you've got to be careful and not forget that those just happen to be the way we do it. Does that make sense? First time I was at a congregation that was a little larger, and just due to the way the auditorium was constructed, they couldn't serve the communion from the front. It just didn't work logistically, the aisles and stuff. It didn't make sense. So they had a table at the back, and they did everything the same. The guy got up, he said the prayer, he blessed it. But it came from the back. I thought, well, that can't be scriptural. You can't bring the trays from the back of the room. But then I started thinking about, well, where is that in my Bible? That's just the way we do it, right? So my point is just not to confuse the one with the other. We end up in kind of culture wars over things that don't matter. And then we use all our energy on those instead of talking about things that will actually matter. Sometimes the culture puts a bad imposition on our worship, and we need to say, whoa, not that. But if we picked every battle on every other little thing, we don't pick the right battles. I've mentioned in a previous lesson, I'll just mention this again, the apostles did a lot of Jewish things in their worship. They worshiped in the temple. They participated in the Sabbath and reading scriptures on the Sabbath. They attended at the synagogue. They had Jewish rituals. Now, none of you do any of those things, right? Because you didn't grow up Jewish. Well, they did. So I understand that in the same way that they look a little different, probably even from the church at Corinth, the church at Jerusalem would have looked different than the church at Corinth. Because the kids that grew up in Corinth never went to synagogue. They were all Gentiles. So some things have to be corrected. So, for example, you read the book of 1 Corinthians, a lot of it is spent telling them how to worship because they have no idea how to do it. And a lot of the time is spent saying, you're not pagans anymore, stop acting like it. But on the other hand, there's a lot of things he doesn't correct, which you can imagine might have been different in a Corinthian church that never grew up in a synagogue. So you have those distinctions that are just going to be natural. Another passage, since I mentioned 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 14 is worth reading. First Corinthians 14 and verse 26. Somebody want to read for us 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 26. 1 Corinthians 14, 26. Alma, thank you. So this is a great passage to kind of explain that, because it assumes in the passage, Paul says, I know when you get together to worship, everybody shows up and kind of wants to do their own thing. What Paul says is, it's your job to figure out how to do that in an edifying way. He's not going to hand you the song chart that says, and the first song will be, and then there'll be a prayer, and then there'll be a song, and then, you know, there's certain things. Right? He doesn't give them the liturgy and say, this is how you're going to do it. The only liturgy, if you want to call it that, worship order he gives them, is on the chapter on communion, where he says, this is the closest thing we've got. On the night our Lord was betrayed, he broke bread and blessed it, and he said these words. And then he took the cup and he blessed it, and he said these words. That's what I was told, and that's what I'm telling you. That's the closest thing you get to a worship order in the Bible, where he says, this is the way we do that. But on these other topics where he talks about, for instance, singing, everyone has a hymn. What hymns did Corinthians sing? Now, I assume if you go to church at Jerusalem, you grew up reading the Psalms, so what did you sing? I assume they sang a lot of Psalms, I assume. Now, they might have taken the Psalms over to Corinth and said, here you go, sing that. But what Paul says, everybody shows up with a hymn they want to sing. I was talking to a friend who had done some missionary work in the Philippines, and one of their struggles was that the only songbooks they had were what kind of songbooks would get donated to a church in the Philippines? Huh? The oldest ones, right? And so the only songbooks they had were like the oldest edition Stamps Baxter song that were from a particular era of music in church life, right? A lot of them still in our book. Nothing wrong with them. It's just that's not how Philippine people sang. It's not the way their music went. In the same way you can tell a guy who wrote a Russian song from a guy who wrote an American song, Philippine music had a different sound to it, and they had trouble singing it just because it's not how music sounded. That's not how their nursery rhymes went. But they didn't know what else to do because that's what it says. That was the book we were told to sing out of, Stamps Baxter. You know, these are the ones. And he said, you could write your own songs. You could make them sound like you wanted to make them sound. Here's a great Bible. Take this and go make some music out of it. And they had a wonderful time. Let me tell you, I finally get to tell my Isaac Watts story. That's how the songs we have came into existence. In the age of Isaac Watts, churches, especially of the Reformation sort, only sang psalms. As late as the 1700s, if you went to a church, they were still singing it verbatim out of the psalms. There's 150 songs in the songbook, and that's what we're singing. And they were chants. I don't know if you've ever heard Gregorian chant. I find it to be great. Not everybody does, okay? My band director at Seminole High School was a deacon at the church there. He's an elder there now. And he would play Gregorian chant as detention music, as kind of a punishment. If you got stuck in detention, he would play the Gregorian stuff. Anyway, so they had chant. Chants aren't for everybody, right? And there's chanting psalms. And so Isaac Watts is walking home from church one day as a fairly young guy. He's walking home with his dad, and he tells his dad, these are terrible songs. This is not how anybody sings today. And his dad said, fix it. Probably the most important thing that happened in that century in Christian history was his dad said, fix it. Write better songs. And so he did. He started writing songs, and he would go back to church, and they would have, kind of like we do, a singing class. And he would teach them these brand new songs that were very provocative, very controversial. They had titles like, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, right? And how do you think churches responded to that? They all said, these are the best songs we've ever heard. Let's start singing them. Is that what they did? Folks, people got up and walked out of his church. And they said, that's not the way we sing. Ready for the punchline of the story? Isaac Watts was a clever cat. In one of his hymns that we still sing, he took a swipe at the people who didn't like his songs. And it's been hidden in your songbook for a couple hundred years now. Isaac Watts making fun of people who didn't sing his songs. You ready? Let those refuse to sing who never knew our God. Let those refuse to sing who never knew our God. But children of the heavenly King will shout their joys abroad. Isaac Watts said, that's what I think of you, not singing my songs. Okay. Point is, there's never been a song written that wasn't controversial the first time somebody sang it, because it wasn't the way we sang it yesterday. Isaac Watts' songs are now archaic, right? Now, I love them, but if you go to most churches around the world today, they don't sing Isaac Watts any more than they sing Gregorian chant. What was he doing? He was using the music available to him in his time to write beautiful songs, and people today are doing the same thing. Were all the songwriters of Isaac Watts' day just as good as the others? No, some of them were terrible. And some of the songs that came from that era have thankfully disappeared into history, and we don't sing them anymore. Some of them have survived because they're magnificent. I think it was Newton, the songwriter Newton, who commented, he would trade every song he had ever written to have written When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. He says, well, that's just a good song. You can't beat that one. Those survive, and we bring them forward, and then we add to that collection, as Paul mentions here. Everybody's got a hymn. You bring your song, and you work with it. So my point is that there are ways in which culture can help by bringing kind of fresh air into our worship, and that's great. What Paul says is we still follow the rules. What were the rules we talked about last week for worship in our sermon on regulated assembly? Anybody remember the three rules? Because you all remember everything I say. Rule number one about worship, what do we ask? Hope I didn't write it on the screen or anything so you can cheat. Yeah. Number one, does it glorify God? Number two, does it please ourselves or others? Are we building people up? And number three, does it point the unbeliever to God? Those are Paul's three questions that just keep coming up. So when I read a passage like Romans chapter 12 in verse 2, when it says, be not conformed to this world, but transformed by the renewing of your mind, I think of these three questions. If the culture is affecting the church in a way that diminishes the glory of God, creates selfishness, or hides the gospel, then those influences of culture have got to go. Because that's contrary to what Christians do in worship. But if there's a new tune or a particular practice or a new kind of chair, right? My parents didn't sit on comfortable chairs in worship either. And they think I'm a little lazy for hatted padding chairs, by the way, just to let you know that. The church chairs they sat on were wood, and that's the way it was. All right. But there are things that are available to us that weren't available in times past. We ask, does it glorify God? Does it please ourselves? Does it point the unbeliever to God? And we kind of go through our checklist. And that's how we discern how the church will continue to interact with the culture. Is that disconcerting? Yeah, because it means it's a moving target. It means the way a worship service looked like in the days of Isaac Watts is not going to be identical to the way that it is today. And it means that my kids will get older someday, and they may do some things that weren't exactly the same way I did them. They might serve communion from the back, who knows. But as long as they're following the New Testament's pattern, as long as they're bringing glory to God, edifying others, and proclaiming the gospel, then the particular nuances of how a worship service is constructed are just not concerns that anybody in the New Testament seems to have. Does that make sense? It's a struggle. It's not fun. I want everything to be the way I like it all the time. But it turns out no one will make me pope, so it's just not going to be that way. Questions or comments before I'm done? Everyone understands everything perfectly. Excellent. We'll stop here, and the boys will come in a few minutes and do their devotional. Maybe they'll even sing something by Isaac Watts.